Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening on Amazon Music is included with your Prime membership. Just head to amazon.com/adfreenewspodcasts to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Enjoy thousands of Acast shows ad-free for Prime subscribers. Some shows may have ads.
Welcome to your 2023 work recap. This year, you've been to 127 sync meetings. You spent 56 minutes searching for files and almost missed 8 deadlines. Yikes. 2024 can and should sound different. With Monday.com, you can work together easily, collaborate and share data, files, and updates. So all work happens in one place and everyone's on the same page. Go to Monday.com or tap the banner to learn more.
We acknowledge the Yuggera and Kaurna nations as traditional custodians of the land on which we work, live and learn, and their continuing connection with the land, waters and community. We pay our respects to them and their elders past and present.
All content related to this program is for general informational purposes only and contains stories and discussions around mental health that may be disturbing to some listeners. If you are concerned about yourself or someone you know, please seek professional individual advice and support. More details are contained in our show notes.
You've really got to work on your resting bitch face, because it's not actually helping your hormonal balances to make you feel good. And even if you're really unhappy and grumpy, if you smile, your body doesn't know you're grumpy.
That's award-winning leader, international keynote speaker, consultant and author Lucy Bloom, and this is Reframe of Mind,
where we deep dive into discussions about mental health, joined by some of Australia's leading minds, to expand our understanding of the world and ourselves.
Because we don't exist in a vacuum, and the way we talk about mental health shouldn't either.
We're your hosts, Louise Poole and Andy Leroy. So how's your resting bitch face, Andy?
Well, it's a little bit less grumpy than it used to be, but let's just say it's a work in progress, although that obviously is a matter of my opinion.
Well, that bitch face has been through a lot so far this season.
Yeah, speak for your own bitch face. It is true, though. I mean, it'd be fair to say that at this point of our journey, the story so far, we're both living life as a bit of an open question.
Yeah, we've thrown down the gauntlet instead of throwing in the towel, and we're committed to having a good hard look at ourselves and some of life's conundrums.
Yeah, and along the way, we've chatted to people who have overcome some pretty significant challenges.
Quadriplegia, amputation.
Getting shot 14 times in under a minute.
Not your average day at the office, but this isn't inspo porn.
No. I mean, everyone has shared their story and their personal why, which has helped us to dig even deeper.
Yeah, other guests have shared scientific or philosophical insight into what we experience from moment to moment as our lives unfold. But we're always conscious that we need to explore things fully rather than just shortcut to that pearl of wisdom, because editing something down to the point of it just becoming a slogan, it's a recipe for disaster, which we otherwise refer to as toxic positivity.
Yes, and this episode's guest has slayed her own dragons and is anything but toxic when it comes to her positivity.
Lucy Bloom is an award-winning leader, international keynote speaker, consultant and author, and she uses her superpowers for writing and speaking about courage, trust, failure, change, maverick thinking, generosity and fun.
She's a charity expert, government's gun and strategy machine, and like Tina Turner, she breaks every rule as an idea maker with exceptional communication strategies.
After running a successful ad agency for 20 years, Lucy founded an international women's health charity and as CEO built a team and created a communication strategy that raised $7 million for a network of hospitals and a midwifery school in Ethiopia. She then moved on to transform Sunrise Cambodia as the charity's first CEO.
Lucy created the world's first childbirth education program written specifically for men, which is run in pubs all over Australia, and is the author of the best-selling book Cheers to Childbirth, which accompanies the program.
And when talking to Lucy, it's pretty easy to see why people warm to her devil-may-care attitude, which is not about disrespecting other people's opinions, but more about not allowing what others to say to dent her armour.
Which is where our conversation began.
You look to me to be similar to me in that you don't care what people think. And I love that.
It's the only way to be. I used to care, and it's exhausting.
It is exhausting, isn't
it? And pointless. Exhausting and pointless. Yeah.
How did you get to that point, though? Because I feel it's something that's come easier as I've gotten older.
Definitely, me too. I think when women hit their 40s, their zero fucks to give pile starts to grow. And mine grew rapidly. I don't know why. What it is about 40 as a round number, as a milestone in life, but I really noticed that in myself, that after 40 I started to care a whole lot less about what other people thought. And I remember reading somewhere, oh no, it was my brother reminded me, and it's a Brené Brown quote. She says, "You have a square piece of paper, 1 inch square, tiny piece of paper, on which to write the names of the people whose opinions matter to you." And I have really big handwriting. And that is really helpful to me, because there's truly a very small list of people whose opinions truly matter to me. And the rest, you know, you can have an opinion, but do I care? Not so much. And then there's so much more time in life when you're not worrying about what anyone else thinks. And on you go, and you do wild things with your hair. And it's funny, if people say to me, oh, you're so brave with my hair.
Yes.
It's only hair. It's not a tattoo on my forehead. It's only hair. And we could start again by shaving it all off tomorrow. It's not that big a deal. It's just fun.
I'm a fat girl, and I wear inappropriate outfits for being a fat girl, according to society. And I always get, oh, you're so brave because you've worn something above your knees. Like, is this really what's brave today?
Yeah, that's a special kind of patronising, isn't it? Oh, well, if you cannot care about those comments too, you're on the way to victory.
Is that something you've had to work at maintaining, or is it something that's become easier the more you do?
Oh, you've definitely got to work at it. There must be something about our neuro setup that we lapse back into caring. It could just be back to the need for approval from the herd type stuff for your survival, to make humans keep going back to that thought and worrying what other people think. But I do need reminding. I remember once whinging to my bestie about what someone else was saying about me. Someone close to me was just criticizing me, and she took a screenshot of one of my Instagram posts, which was about not caring what other people think. She screenshot my own Instagram post and just messaged it to me, no words.
That's always nice when people come straight back with your own words. Love it.
Correct. Yes, she's absolutely right. And I have another friend who said to me once, compliments are all very nice, but it's what you think of yourself that really matters. And along those lines, it was so, that hit me at just the right time too. Like, we sort of, humans tend to seek approval, and not just approval. We really, really thrive on compliments. But they're just nice to have. They're not necessary for survival. It's what you think of yourself that matters. I look in the mirror in the morning and I just go, I love my hair. It friggin' rocks. And that's all that matters.
It's interesting, because you do talk about there being, I guess, a bit of a kind of fakeness in niceness as well.
Yes, I do. It's nice to be nice, but it's better to be bold, which is actually a headline written by Jane Caro. And I truly live by that. It's nice to be nice, but, yeah, there's some fakery under that. If you're nice to everyone all the time, it's better to be bold and direct. I find myself seeking out, and this may be a post-40 thing too, I've got a much smaller circle of close friends, and then I don't bother. But I'm not unkind. I just spend my juicy time with the really juicy people. And you know, they say you're the sum of the five people you spend the most time with. I guess I seek out the genuine people and the weirdos like me. So nice is nice, but it's better to be bold and brave.
Do you think you approach the world with kind of curiosity? Because I noticed that she said something about studying neuroscience and stuff like that to learn more about how the brain and your emotions work.
Well, yeah, something has to explain the way humans behave. They're such peanuts half the time.
I know.
I find myself, when I can't understand humans, I go, okay, what's the brain trying to do? So I can just understand why people make such terrible choices for themselves, or they treat each other terribly, or they do self-defeating crap. I just think, what's the brain? There's usually a survival mechanism going on, and I find that helpful to understand, and then I'm far more forgiving of people because you're just this body being driven around by a brain. So, yes, I am curious. I've also learned a lot from other people who've been willing to teach me. So I've learned a huge amount from my online community, especially my Facebook community. So it's not huge. There's only about 8,000 people in that community, but they have taught me so much. But you have to be willing to listen. But also those people who are willing to teach also have to be gentle. I find when people try to correct me or tell me I have it wrong, if they do it in a way that is patronizing or rude or a smackdown, my ears just close off. My brain, my heart, everything just goes, fuck off. But if they come at you kindness isn't quite the right word, with a willingness to teach, then I'm all ears. And I've just learned so much from just random people in my community who've been willing to teach me. And I guess you have to have that curiosity.
What's the most interesting thing you've learned from that community?
I remember one case was, remember when Serena Williams was smacked down by a ref and she took him to task that it was because she was a woman? And it was something to do with her coach doing signals, and he accused her of cheating. And I remember her saying, I don't need to cheat. and then it followed up with a really unflattering cartoon of her.
Yes.
That was awful.
Yep.
But I remember thinking, well, in the cartoon sense, it does kind of look like Serena Williams. And she was having a bit of a dummy spit. And I posted this picture and it began a discussion. And someone taught me, there were lots of people just chopping my legs off, how dare you even have an opinion on this? You are not a black woman, you don't get to say. But there was someone who said to me, who explained to me, there's something really subtle in this drawing. It actually harks back to a style of drawing that goes back to that whole gollywog style of putting down black people as slaves and useless, and I had no idea of that historical context that was inside that, that was beneath the surface of that drawing, and how deeply offensive that was. And so she taught me, but she taught me with, she was logical and careful, and she wasn't rude. She didn't smack me down for being a stupid white lady, even though she could have. And because she was gentle with me and logical, I was all ears, and I learnt so much. So I'm always grateful when people are willing to do that and teach me something.
I think that willingness to be open to be taught as well is important, because I follow a lot of Indigenous people in the community on Twitter, and I have a lot of caution in actually entering any debates, because I'm not Indigenous. I follow a lot of Indigenous women. I'm not an Indigenous woman either, just for the record. But what I do like to do is to actually retweet what they're saying, because I feel it's important to amplify their voices. And sometimes some conversations will come out of that. But for me, it seems to be more important sometimes to amplify the voices of others than to actually pitch in with my two cents.
Yes, do you think that too?
Yeah. Do you think that there is probably more space for that kind of interaction where we're sitting as a society at the moment?
Yeah, absolutely. And social media gives people like me the platform to do that and to amplify voices of others. And when it's a situation like racism, it's the perfect amplification. It's a perfect way to do that, to open up a discussion without me having my two cents worth. It's sharing those voices. So many of these platforms are all about sharing content, and I could share without commenting or without saying, oh, this person shouldn't be offended. That's what I learned from that, is it's not my place to decide who's offended by something.
Yeah, Louise and I sometimes have fun with trolls on the Instagram page that she runs. And
we love picking on trolls.
They're great for the algorithm, but we also have learned to shut them down pretty efficiently, which is good, by telling them how good they are for the algorithm. So
They want to go away as soon as you tell them that they're actually helping your content get promoted to more people.
Yes, indeed. There's a bit of a sort of gang culture there too. I was picked on. Somehow I got dragged into a conversation. Someone tagged me and dragged me in and asked what I thought about, we have a ladies' baths in Sydney, and I think it's the last surviving in Australia. An ocean pool by the beach, not far from my house, ladies only. And every 4 years or so, there's some stupid lawyer with too much time on their hands, drags it through the discrimination tribunal or whatever it is, commission I think it is, and it retains its ladies only status. But somehow I got dragged into this conversation because there was a statement about trans women and whether they could attend the baths. But there was a problem with boys wearing skirts just to get a looky inside the baths because most women go topless there. And so there's this tricky thing of like, well, you want to have a be open and inclusive of trans people, but you don't want people to scam that policy. And our local council just made a really bad statement that wasn't well thought through, and I got dragged into this conversation somehow. And unfortunately, I said something like, it's really not that big a deal, it's just a dumb statement by council. And then I think every trans campaigner in Australia took me on. So I had to just decide this actually isn't my argument to have, and I just went on a banning festival and they left me alone. So sometimes you've got to pick your arguments, and an argument about trans policy actually isn't mine. Even though it's my local pool and I love it and I'm a woman and I go there, that, you know, Randwick Council can dig themselves out of their own stupid hole.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's true.
Yeah.
So it seems like you're someone who is very good at reinvention. I feel like you've had a lot of different, careers or like different projects, and I think that it's a special kind of person that can do that, because that takes one of the things that you talk about, which is courage.
Yeah, I guess so. It's really not that admirable. It's just that I bore easily. Seriously, I do, and even in a really exciting role after a while, what I bore with is business as usual. I love creating something out of nothing, seeing it fly, seeing it succeed. But once it's business as usual, then I'm sort of looking for the next, I call it in my book Chasing Squirrels, where you see the next exciting project and then you chase that one. So yeah, I was quite reasonably sensible for the first 20 years of my career. I ran my own boutique advertising agency, and that was pretty stable. That was the same thing for 20 years straight, but that's a long time for me to do the same thing.
I can definitely relate to that, because I don't think I've actually stuck in the same thing for any longer than about 2 years, except for a couple of exceptions, because I go through this phase as well where I've learnt everything, I've actually, you know, come to some point of mastery with something, and then I get bored. I need to find the next thing. Yeah. So I suppose a question out of that is, how do you make something for yourself that you can keep building on to actually avoid that sense of boredom?
Yeah, it's just getting better and better at it. Well, I've only done this a few times, but I've got better and better at it until I could sell it. And then someone else can give it the new energy and love that it needs going forward. I ran the ad agency, then I was in the not-for-profit sector, and that was such a learning curve. That was 5 years of, wow, I had so much to learn from private enterprise to the not-for-profit sector, reporting to a board. There's just so much to learn. I think while I'm still learning, I'm still interested and excited, and I'm still paving new neural pathways through my little brain, and it still really interests me. These days I'm speaking a lot, and I'm improving that as much as I can, and learning all the time and getting better at it, and practicing my humour. I'm trying to get funnier at it, because people remember the funny speaker. No one goes, that speaker, you know, the really boring one at the start, how awesome was that? but they remember the funny speaker, and then you can tie in the learnings into the humour. So I'm really practicing at getting better at that, and I'm writing. So I've just written my first novel, and that was a learning experience, so new and so such a different way of writing to nonfiction, which I've written before. So I guess to answer your question, it's to keep learning. As while I'm learning, I don't get bored. And so I'm not currently looking for, I'm not itchy at the moment. I'm still in this learning phase where I'm like, hooly dooly, how do I pull off this novel so that the reader lobs it across the room and has a cry at the end? They're so sad it's over. that takes quite a bit of work. So that's what I'm trying to perfect at the moment.
Would you say that you're driven more by risk or reward when it comes to finding new adventures?
Oh, what a cracker question.
Thank you.
Well, they come hand in hand, don't they? They dance together, those two. You can't expect reward without risk. I guess the projects that really hold my attention have a level of risk, but also have a level of newness to them. I like creating new things that haven't quite been done before. So I love a world first. I really do love a world first. So when I created the world first childbirth education program for men, I adored that program because no one had done it before. So I was really creating something totally new to take medical information and make it snappy and fast and fun and listenable, but in man speak. No one had ever done it before. And so I loved that. And as I said, I grew it till I could sell it because I was on to the next thing in my first CEO role. So I think it's both risk and reward. I found that was risk, wasn't enormously risky because there was no financial risk. It was just a huge whop of my time, and I built that before Facebook, before Eventbrite existed. I had to create the code. I had to learn everything from scratch. I had to work out how am I going to get hospitals to promote pubs because it was run in pubs all over Australia. How am I going to get over that hurdle? So it wasn't too risky. I mean, when I published my first book, I remember I always say to people, Lucy Bloom, risk management framework is two questions. What's the worst thing that could happen? And will anybody die? And when I published my first book, the worst thing that could happen is it didn't sell, and every time I opened my garage door, there would be 70 cartons of books looking back at me, reminding me that I'm a loser. And I thought, I can deal with that. I just put one in the bin. I just put one in the garbage once a week until they're gone, I guess. If it was a total face plant. But that's not that much of a risk, and that all comes down to self-perception, what I think of myself. So when you think hard about risks, often it's just about you're worrying what other people will think of the failure rather than the actual risk. So creating that book, creating those workshops, it was just time and learning and effort and not a lot of money, and it flew. So the reward was fabulous, bit of risk, bit of reward. Yeah, it all goes hand in hand.
I was just about to ask you if you think that the secret to overcoming the fear of failure is confronting that worst-case scenario. It kind of sounds like you might.
Yeah, definitely. Confront the worst-case scenario and then scrunch it up in a ball, flush it down the loo, and then start focusing on the best-case scenario. That's what I do when things are a bit out of my control, when I can't control the worst case scenario happening. I almost fantasize about the best case scenario because I have just as much control over that. So I actually just find that a good way to stop myself getting anxious about things. But in a practical sense, when you're working on a project, when you chase a squirrel, when you pick up some crazy idea and you run with it, consider the worst case scenario. And I bet you it's mainly what other people might think.
I think that's one of the reasons it stops us from doing anything, isn't it? It's we kind of procrastinate and give ourselves all these excuses, but ultimately why we don't write the book, or we write the book and then we don't put it out, or we make the podcast and then we debate on whether to hit publish, it really is somewhere along the line we are worried about it being a failure in other people's eyes.
Yeah, and it goes right back to caring what other people think. You know, you have one wild, precious life in which to do everything you will ever do. And if you pull back from doing some things that might be fun or might be a hilarious failure or might inform the next project, if you pull back from that because you're worried what other people will think, you're not living your life. You're not living your life. You're living a half-assed life. That sounds really depressing to me.
What things have you learned from failing?
Oh, I've learned a lot about myself. I've learned I am not an ass kisser. I am a terrible ass kisser. If a project or a job or something requires that I kiss ass, I am not the lady for that job. I'm not a very good politician either, because I find it all a bit inauthentic, where people are sort of lobbying for, I could not be a politician, partly because women are treated so terribly in that profession, but because there's so much under the surface and it lacks transparency, I guess what I'm getting at. I've learnt so many practical things. I remember once I had an awesome chick working for me, Isabel, and she said, right, we have to text. Well, what we want to do is text all our donors. We'd had something tragic happen and an outgoing staff member had destroyed 1,000 donors' credit card details. And this is so tragic. Like for a charity, it was like, no, that was our bread and butter. And so we had to – it actually ended up being wonderful because we had to get in contact with 1,000 people. And I put a whole team of volunteers on it, and most of them increased their donation over the phone when we said, we just need to update your credit card details. And I put some really cruisy, super Aussie volunteers on it who had all the time in the world to chit-chat to our donors, didn't rush it, and we wound up with a higher income than when the tragedy began. But what I learned was my staff member said, oh, some people weren't getting back to us. Let's text them. Let's just do an SMS that says, please get in touch with us. It's a brilliant idea. So she set it up, and then she said to me, shall we stage these texts or just do one big blast? And I'm a big blast kind of lady. And I just said, just blast it. So she blasted it and it was 10 to 5. And she sent 880 text messages all at the same time, telling them all to phone us. And we had 4 phone lines. It was the biggest cock up.
But effective, obviously.
It was so bad. And within 15 seconds, we all looked at each other and we all knew what had happened. And it was so bad. And I said to Isabel, I said, look, that was a team effort. I let you do that. I should never have let you do that. I will take the fall for this one. Don't you worry. So, I mean, we did come out fine in the end, but yes, I've learned a lot about some little technical things. You know, when a platform suggests you do something, there's probably a reason.
Nice to know, though, that a blast of text messages works as an effective marketing strategy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it does work. Lots thought it was some kind of scam and that made them phone us, which was good. But, yeah, we needed them. We should have sent, 10 every hour until it was done.
Oh, well. You don't know until you try, do you?
That's right.
Yep. Yeah. You seem to be very good at reframing things and being able to take another perspective on things. One of the things I was reading that you say around this concept of living each day like it's your last, you're more of a fan of just have a go.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's a terrible saying. I am not a fan of living each day as if it's your last, because you would never do sensible things like pay bills. I would never do a water change on my tropical fish tank if today was my last day. I wouldn't finish renovating that gorgeous little table I'm working on. I would just love bomb my children. So that makes no sense. I understand what it's getting at. It's like live each day with that idea that you only have one life in which to do everything you'll ever do. You're right. I am more of a person who thinks that you should just give it a red hot go. Whatever it is that interests you or that excites you, just give it a go. Just try. Do your worst thing that could happen, question, and just give it a try. There are lots of things I still want to try, and not many industries I haven't been able to decipher, not many things you can't Google and just sort of figure out how people come at these things. It's just easy to learn with the internet. Give it a red hot go.
It's a conversation that Louise and I often have. We explore the concept of toxic positivity every now and then, and we kind of wonder whether certain statements that are being made online or even in general media in general might actually be just a veneer, and there's something much deeper under that that people just aren't getting because it hasn't been fully explored. How do you feel about some of these affirmations that are kind of getting around?
Good vibes only, or even the one that you said is what made me think of it, where, you know, that kind of live each day like it's your last. I mean, that's it's not practical.
I'd spend the whole day crying.
Yeah.
This shit day.
Yeah. You know, don't worry, be happy, all that kind of stuff. It's stuff that just kind of doesn't hit the mark.
Yeah, it's floppy, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm an optimistic person because it feels better. I make lots of choices because it feels better rolling around in this body of mine. So I choose things because they're fun, for example, rather than super serious stuff. But you're right about toxic positivity being just like sort of surface. It's a bit like peanut butter on top when there's actually jelly underneath it. I prefer to be optimistic, and my philosophy in life is to just keep moving forward, especially when things are really, really tough. So some really tough things have happened to me in my life, and the only way I can see through them is to just keep moving forward. And what that forward looks like is different for everyone. So for me, it might be reinventing myself, changing my career. You know, I got fired, bam, I changed my career then. My marriage ends, okay, I've got a whole new next decade where I'm not living in a nuclear family like I thought I would for the rest of my life. I get to reframe my whole life. I see that as an opportunity. I have some time to grieve it, but then you can only move forward. So I'm not a fan of toxic masculinity either. Toxic positivity.
Same.
I'm not a fan of that, and you know, it might be cute on a t-shirt, but it actually doesn't soothe anyone. And I think it tries to, but doesn't work. And the best way to soothe someone like me, because we're all different, is to acknowledge that something is shit, and then help that person keep moving forward. Just keep moving along, little steps, keep moving forward.
I'm going to do a little circuit breaker here and say thanks for listening to us. If you love the show, let us know. Hit the subscribe button on your podcast app and show us those 5-star ratings. Remember to tell your friends about us and check our Patreon page for access to even more content, like extended interviews at patreon.com/reframeofmind. The more people we get talking about mental health, the more supported we'll all be.
This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony. Finding someone who gets you is hard, right? You're not alone. That's because we're human, and there's a lot of different humans out there, which is why eHarmony's personality-based dating app helps you find someone you can be your whole self with, someone you can be fully comfortable with. That's what true connection and compatibility are all about. Being seen, heard, understood. When you match based on personality, you're already one step ahead when it comes to getting to know one another. So try eHarmony and get started today for free. eHarmony, get who gets you.
Welcome to your 2023 work recap. This year, you've been to 127 sync meetings, you spent 56 minutes searching for files and almost missed 8 deadlines. Yikes. 2024 can and should sound different. With Monday.com, you can work together easily, collaborate and share data, files, and updates. So all work happens in one place and everyone's on the same page. Go to Monday.com or tap the banner to learn more.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening on Amazon Music is included with your Prime membership. Just head to amazon.com/adfreenewspodcast to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Enjoy thousands of Acast shows ad-free for Prime subscribers. Some shows may have ads.
I think you've actually hit the nail on the head there by saying that it is different for everybody. So, and I'm aware that, you know, you had quite a serious accident when you were younger, and it must have taken a lot of strength to get through that, especially in the first instance. What was the thing that helped you the most to be the person you are today?
Those are hard questions when it's like the number one thing.
Sorry. Just your top five then.
Well, there are a few things. I touched on it earlier, the idea of not obsessing over the worst case scenarios. When I had that accident, I had a really serious motorcycle accident. It looked like I was going to lose my leg. But that, the care of my leg was out of my hands. It wasn't up to me to make the decisions or perform the surgery that would or wouldn't save my leg. That's really hard to surrender to just go under a general anaesthetic, not sure if you're going to wake up with one leg or two, is true surrender. So because that was all out of my control, it took a year, a week and a day to save my leg. I found myself consciously taking my thoughts out of the worry, the anxiety and the worst case scenarios, and pushing them towards the, not even the best case, total fantasy land. And that's because it feels better. That's where I find myself always seeking what feels better. And it felt better to it felt better to fantasize and plan. And so one of my fantasies was to set up an ad agency of my own, which I did go on to do. And one was really fun. It was to ride a motorcycle across America. And I spent weeks planning this trip with maps and guidebooks, and it just gave me a distraction, but a really fun fantasy distraction. I'd specced up the bike, I was going to buy the works, and that I've kept that with me for the rest of my life, that when things are out of control, you've done your best, and then the rest is up to the way life folds. I find it much more positive and helpful for me to fantasize about what can go right. So instead of losing sleep over, say, a really stressful meeting the next day, or for me these days it's like a huge speech in front of a huge audience. I gave a speech in 2019 to 14,000 people in Barcelona, and that was my biggest speech ever. And it was to Europeans and Americans. And it was the first time I was testing Lucy Bloom humor on a bunch of foreigners, and that was scary. And the only way to, so I could prepare, do my best, but then the night before I was getting myself really anxious, and I decided I have to use my own, this is my own technique, just fantasize about how this can go right. So I was literally picturing how the audience at the end, I didn't actually picture my speech, I knew it back to front, but the audience at the end gave me a standing ovation. There's all these Europeans with their beautiful skin clapping at me. And then someone comes on stage with an unexpected novelty check for $100,000. And then I look closely and the person handing me that check is George Clooney. And then, you know, it's a really creative thing to do, like how can I make this even better? And you find yourself distracted from what might be making you anxious. It triggers all the right hormones to make you feel good. You sleep better. All those things sort of roll into each other. And so that's one of the things that I learnt during that particularly challenging part of my life that's made life richer.
I have to say, dwelling on all of the things that could go right sounds infinitely more appealing than dwelling on all the things that could go wrong. Do you find that you need to take this incrementally? Like if you're reaching for something that feels better, then you think, oh, actually, what can I do that even better? I think I got a sense that you're actually reaching in incrementally and building on it to make it even bigger step by step rather than leaping to that end point, yeah?
Yes, and also if this is like a real project you're thinking of doing, or the numbers never lie. So while you're fantasizing and big sky dreaming and giving it all a red hot go and not caring what other people think, underneath all of that, the numbers never lie. Hmm. So that keeps you down to earth. That stops you doing crazy crap that is going to just lose you stacks of money.
Hmm.
So that's what keeps me balanced, is being savvy about the numbers and realistic about the numbers.
Often wonder where that difference in thinking lies between. Like, I think it's a real entrepreneurial thing. So, I mean, two people could be faced with the same situation, and one person believes they can, and the other person believes they can't. And so, someone manifests this incredible, you know, on stage getting their giant check in front of 15,000 people scenario, and somebody else doesn't. Like, I always think this is it. Is it down to mindset, like what we believe that we can do and teach ourselves that we can do versus if we kind of undermine ourselves and say, no, well, that's just a fantasy. We couldn't achieve something like that.
I think it's a mixture of mindset and the things that have tripped you up in the past. So if things have if you have completely cocked up a speech in the past, the thought of doing something huge like that would just be too overwhelming, too scary, because your brain remembers how it felt when you really screwed something up really badly. I actually remember seeing a client of mine. He had two huge glasses of red wine right before he launched a product, and I was just in the background. This was when I ran my agency, and I learned through his pain and suffering as he completely cocked up that presentation in front of a room full of architects. Too much red wine running through his veins, and he just couldn't remember anything he was meant to say. And there were these hideous pauses that were so painful. I just wanted to, like, grab a sheet and, like, throw it over his head to kind of save him from the terror that he was going through. And so I have learned that you never, ever drink a sip, not even one sip, of booze when you're on the job. But I learned that from him. So you learn from these, you learn from these failures. And I think that might be an indicator whether you go, yeah, I can give that a go, or whether you go, that is not for me. And that stuff, you really hold those feelings in your cells forever. And it takes, I remember reading about how it takes, something has to be something like 12 times more fabulous than it was bad for it to really lodge in your memory, like, yes, that was so good, I will do that again. Something doesn't have to be that bad for you to go, I'm never doing that again. Mm. And that's your survival instincts, because you don't have to feel fabulous to survive. But you need to avoid the things that could kill you, that could destroy you, that, you know. So I think it comes down to a mixture of confidence, giving it a red hot go, but also the mistakes you've made in the past.
I like that one of those things in there that you're saying is that you have just as much control over the best case scenario as you do over the worst case scenario.
Yeah.
Because when we've been putting this program together, we've spoken to a lot of psychologists, neuroscientists, people like that, and they've pretty much given us this theory or this evidence that often the brain can't tell whether what you're thinking is really happening or an imagined reality.
Yeah.
So if you're tricking yourself into that and you're creating all those good feeling hormones, then whether it's real in actual real manifested life or just in your fantasy, you're reaping the benefits from it.
So true.
Yeah.
And, you know, I always say to people, you've really got to work on your resting bitch face, because that is not actually helping your hormonal balances to make you feel good. And even if you're really unhappy and grumpy, if you smile, your body doesn't know you're grumpy, and you can fox your body with a smile. How awesome is that? And I always say to people, also work on your phone face. Have you ever looked at where you look in the camera on your phone when you're not expecting it?
Always.
How horrendous
that is. Ignore the double chins. Everybody has those. But if you can actually smile more and be happier through your face, your body will benefit, even if you're not unhappy. I think that's awesome.
You know the secret to good radio, Lucy?
What's that?
Where if you smile when you're talking, like I always do now, I can't even help myself because it's something I've ingrained in myself, you always sound happy and energetic, and you just It's a thing people do.
I didn't know that.
Good speaking. You always smile when you speak because it kind of puts that energy in your voice.
Well, I laugh at my own jokes. Does that count?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, totally.
I mean, look, it's not so good when you're on a, you know, a regional station and you've got to do the Saturday morning funeral announcements and, you know.
Right.
And you can't help but accidentally smile, and then the boss comes in and says, I think you sounded too happy doing the funeral announcements today. But for every other situation, it's good. And I think it's a similar thing. Your body is just putting it out there because you're tricking yourself into those endorphins.
Yeah, that's right. Milk those endorphins, baby. They feel good.
Do whatever works.
Mm, agreed.
It's actually call center 101 as well that you must. Yeah, absolutely. I don't know how many people I've taught to smile while you're on the phone because you sound a lot nicer, happier. It carries. It does carry.
Yeah, but it also feels nicer for you.
It does. So
that's the bonus.
Much nicer to smile at work than to feel like you've got 8 hours of dread.
Yes, indeed. And smile at strangers in the street. I do it all the time. People stare at me and they stare at my hair, so I just smile back.
Something else I've written down here is, it must have been from a video we watched of yours this morning, is you said something along the lines of no can always become a yes, and I really like that philosophy. So, I mean, I'd love it if you kind of tell us more about that.
Oh, yeah, totally. So many people are afraid of no, like no is a terminal condition, and it's just the rejection that comes with a no that they fear. I remember having an old school friend, and I stopped inviting her out because she always said no. And that was only because I didn't like being rejected, not because, I don't know, it was exhausting to ask her anything. But people aren't fond of no. But you can totally turn no's into yeses by just coming at them at a different angle. So you can come at a different person. My kids do that to me and their father all the time. So if they get a no from me, they'll try their dad. My youngest is particularly clever. She has worked out that if she asks me for $30 to go shopping with her friends, I'll say no. But if she asks me for $10, to me that sounds like a meal, and then she asks her dad for $10 and her grandmother for $10, she gets the same result. So divide up, divide and conquer. It's a bit like, you know, it's a bit like the government. You can put in grants at state level, federal level and local level, you know, come at divide and conquer. So you can also, I've also noticed that people are more likely to say yes to you in person than they are over email or text. So if this really matters to you, have the courage to ask in person. If they say no the first time, come back at them in person, make the ask slightly smaller. I remember once asking someone to give me 3 speeches for free. And it's rare that I ask people to do that because I don't speak for free. And he said, no, I can't manage it. So I came back at him about a month later. I had a coffee with him in Sydney and asked him to give me 1 speech, and he said yes. So coming at different angles, resize the ask. And it's a numbers game too. No, people in sales have no idea what we're talking about right now because they are so used to no. It's just a numbers game, and they just keep asking until they get a yes, and they keep perfecting the way they ask, and they just ask more and more and more people. So yeah, you just get used to no's. Also, come at something assuming you're going to get a no, and it changes the way you ask because you're not invested in the result, and you're braver in what you'll ask. So come at something with the assumption of a no. That's how I come to be with my partner. I never imagined he would say yes, and he said yes.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's sweet.
Yeah.
Why do you think kindness is important?
You know why? Because it feels good and it makes you live longer.
Does it?
Doesn't it?
Yeah, I give a whole speech on how to use kindness to extend your life expectancy.
Well, we didn't watch that one this morning.
There's a stack of research on that. There's the Kindness Institute, which I think comes out of UCLA. It was funded by a very philanthropic couple, the Kindness Institute. And there's a whole stack of research on kindness, why people are kind, how they respond to certain types of generosity. But, yeah, kindness, it triggers all those same fabulous feel-good hormones. People start having those benefits when they just start planning to be kind, when they're just working out what they'll do. They haven't even done it yet. Then they do it and they have benefits from that also. And obviously the recipient of kindness feels great as well, and it messes with their blood pressure, makes them feel more valued. There's so much to it. It's fabulous. But then there's an interesting finding that what was unexpected in that kindness is contagious. And when people see other people being kind to others, they want in too, and it makes them want to do the same kind of thing. So there's actually a lot of science behind kindness, but if you want to be selfish about it, it does actually make you live longer. Every day you should be doing something kind. Ideally, you keep a journal for what the kind acts you do each day, and that makes you see if you've gone for a month and not done anything kind at all to anyone, anywhere. Yeah, it's incredible. Kindness should be part of every business plan, every strategic plan. Every grant, I think, that the government gives should have how do you deliver kindness? How are you going to deliver kindness with this grant?
How do you deliver kindness to people who are unkind to you?
Well, they're the ones who need it the most.
Mm.
Hmm.
Absolutely, they're the ones who need it the most. Yeah, you have to.
But is there...
You can do it anonymously too, if they're really that awful. You can be kind on an anonymous level.
If someone approaches you and they are unkind, if they're mean or if they're cruel or any of the variations of that, how do you actually personally treat them with kindness? How do you, because the first response, I mean, if someone's mean to me, I kind of want to be mean back.
Yeah, it's the human response to defend yourself.
Mm. Whereas I just want to shut them out.
Yeah. Here's a perfect story to illustrate. You can use kindness to educate too. They're always coming from their own life and all their own baggage and all that stuff. I remember once, a couple of years ago, I have a disabled permit because I have chronic pain with this injury, my leg, which I got to save, by the way. Spoiler alert.
Yay.
Well done.
But it has left me in chronic pain that I've had to learn to deal with, and I have a disabled permit on my car. And I pulled up and I cruised past a bus stop and pulled into a parking space, just a normal street park. And as I got out of my car, there were a stack of people standing at this bus stop. And the guy at the bus stop yelled out to me, "Oh, you don't look disabled." just like that. And I sort of crumbled a bit. I went, "Oh," because I had to defend myself in front of all these people. And I said, "Thank you. I have been trying for nearly 30 years to look not disabled." And the poor guy, he did shrink a bit. And I didn't need to show him scars or anything like that. But you never know when there's so many hidden disabilities. You don't have to be in a wheelchair or blind to be disabled.
No.
And so I guess you can use a level of kindness. Like I could have just sworn at him or, I could have responded to him in lots of different ways. But to be passive and to teach him something was probably the kindest thing I could do.
Mm.
I think the thank you was probably the thing that threw him there, hey?
Yeah. Actually, that is a really good technique. When someone really disagrees with you and gives you an absolute dressing down, to thank them and then agree with them first really takes the steam out of an argument. So if you go, "You know what, you are absolutely right," and you tell them what part of their statement is right, and then you can come back at them with what part of that statement is totally wrong. But all the steam is gone when you've thanked them and told them they're right. Yeah.
It kind of opens up that channel to communicate, isn't it? Because if we defend ourselves, and it just automatically gets argumentative and then they shut down and we shut down. But if you, engage with them in that conversation, that's when change can really happen.
Yeah, which is the kind thing to do. If you're really argumentative, you come back and tell someone that they're an idiot or they're all wrong and this is why, that all triggers cortisone, and that doesn't feel very nice at all, and that blocks melatonin, which makes you sleep well. So when you have this conflict and these horrid arguments, it doesn't feel good. So, again, it's kind of selfish. Do the thing that feels good, and being kind feels way better than being argumentative or mean or spiteful. But pick your battles.
I love that kindness is selfish. That's the quote I'm writing down to take out of this today.
Yeah,
I love it.
Extends your life expectancy.
Just touching on fixing sleep, as somebody who doesn't really sleep very well, what do you know about us? You mentioned kindness helps you sleep better. So what's your take on that?
Yeah, good old melatonin is the hormone that makes you sleep well.
Yeah.
And you can't produce that if you're really stressed. It's blocked by cortisol. And that's your stress hormone. And most people live on a lot of cortisol.
Mm.
Stress and adrenaline. Adrenaline and cortisol are mates. So you can't be all keyed up and full of adrenaline and go to sleep easily. So that's why it's better not to work out at night. It's better to work out in the morning. And that fits in with the way your body can work to produce the right cocktail of hormones that makes you feel good all day and sleep well at night. I always sleep so much better when I've exercised as early as I can in the day. So for me, I mean, everyone's different, but for me, it comes down to exercise, stress, good food. If I drink booze, I wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning, angry with myself. I don't know why. I fall asleep easily and then I wake up at 2 a.m. So,
it's the sugar.
Yeah. So exercise for me is the way to make sure I sleep well. Wear yourself out like a toddler.
So what do you think is in your personal toolbox every day towards, you know, good mental health, being kind to people, having courage? What are the actual specifics of how you manage your day or week?
Yeah, I'm actually quite selfish. So that came up earlier with kindness, but you have to put yourself first. The old put your oxygen mask on before the children with you. You have to look after yourself first, and then you can help everyone else, and you can be a better mum, better friend, all those things. So I'm selfish about having the time to exercise and do the things I really enjoy. I live by the beach, and I need the ocean air through my hair in winter, all over my body in summer. I'm selfish about. I love living alone, which is quite a selfish thing to be, especially when I'm a mother of three children. My children live with their dad during the week and me on weekends, and that is such a luxury. It's what he wanted, and it's worked out to be actually just right for our family. Mm. He likes routine. I'm the more spontaneous person, and I love living alone and having what I need, which is peace and quiet, time to do the things I really enjoy, to eat well, look after myself first, and then I have energy and good health and everything that I need to bring to the world. So it's actually putting myself first. And I didn't learn that until I was in my 40s.
I love that flips the gender norm on the head, by the way. I love it.
Yeah, good, eh?
Yeah, that's awesome.
I'm all for it.
Yeah, it didn't come out of a great situation. I remember he said to me, I will fight you for the children and I will win.
Mm.
And I was so exhausted, and his best friend was a family lawyer, and I thought, he will. He probably will. And that'll just make us all poorer. So I gave in from the start. And I'm glad I did, because it saved us all a whole lot of trouble. And it actually really suits us all. Suits him and the way he likes to live his life, and me the way I like to live mine. Kids have a beach house on weekends, a bush house during the week. It's kind of cool. It works.
I've kind of thought recently about the semantics we use in our thought processes and where we explore things. And there have been times where I've thought that sometimes we get caught up too much in the words that we use, but I wonder what you think of the value of some of these words and the differentials, because just hearing you talk about what you have and the experience you're having with it, people could easily misconstrue your love for solitude as loneliness. People will often say they're ruminating about death, where it might actually be rumination about mortality. Do we need to kind of slow down a little bit and actually have a think about what we're actually pondering?
Yeah, I think though that does come out of the kind of person you are. I'm an optimist, so things like loneliness, I think of, and I can only speak for myself, loneliness can come down to a perception of what others might think of having a Saturday night at home alone. Whereas I think a Saturday night at home alone is the most glorious thing ever.
Agreed.
Yeah.
But it's all in moderation. I get plenty of people time. I speak to big audiences and then they all want a piece of me afterwards. And so I'm far from alone. And I go back to a hotel room and all I want to do is not speak.
Yeah.
Because I've had, 100 conversations that day. So I'm certainly not suggesting that someone who spends all their time alone shouldn't be lonely and should think positively about alone time. I can only speak from my own experience. Yeah,
Comes back to what you were saying, isn't it, about not really taking too much heed of what other people say. You've really got to kind of listen to yourself and what you actually authentically think about the situation.
Yeah, and if a Saturday night I started to feel sad, I know I would go and seek out company. Hmm. And if that's just a rip-roaring chat on the internet with a bunch of chicks, or I go and do a hot yoga class or something to get out amongst other people, or I sign up to a dance class or something, that's what I would do if it started to make me feel sad, if that aloneness started to make me feel sad. Mm. But you said something about the meaning of words, and my theory on that is if the words hurt others, then those are meanings we need to consider. And if they don't, then they don't. I mentioned my partner, and he worked overseas for a long time, about 15 years, and is only back in Australia over the last 2 or 3. And he said in that time, Australia has really changed. And actually my brother said the same thing. He and his family lived in Madagascar for 10 years. And when they got back to Australia, they said, my goodness, Australia has changed so radically. It has become incredibly politically correct. There's all these words you can't say anymore. And I guess we've all grown with this new dictionary, I guess, this more enlightened dictionary, so that we don't use words like retard, and we know why.
Mm.
We understand that words like that are offensive to some people. But if you've been away for a decade or 15 years, you come back and you use that word and you wonder why everyone's got their knickers in such a giant knot. And it's because those words hurt. So I'm constantly explaining words or pointing out words like, yeah, can't say that. Yeah, no, can't say that. It's a good learning experience to have to actually articulate why, exactly why. Mm. Well, that is based on this, and that is why. And, oh, okay.
That's also the way to kill a racist joke too, by the way, when you tell people you don't understand the punchline and ask them to explain it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that you are naturally an optimist, or is it something that you've worked at?
A little bit of both, a bit of nature-nurture. A bit of both. I think I'm naturally optimistic, but I think I've had some good people around me. When I have gone into my own little bucket of dread, they've dug me out and reminded me. My mum is a really optimistic person, and she's modelled that to me. So it's a bit of both.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like I say, I chase what feels good. Being optimistic feels so much better than doom and gloom. And like, oh, that'll fail. Oh, that'll never work. Much more fun to explore and see and give it a go.
Yeah, I think if there's anything that I'm taking out of today, it's really just to have a go and make sure I'm having fun doing it.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
And I'm going to continue being selfish.
Excellent.
It's all about the balance.
Excellent. I don't do projects unless they look fun. If it doesn't look fun, I'm busy that year.
Yeah.
Awesome. I'm washing my hair.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I'm glad that you thought that we might be fun to talk to, and really appreciate your time this morning, Lucy.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. We've loved this.
Now you can see why we decided to run this interview from beginning to end. Lucy was great fun to speak with.
And you can connect with Lucy on her website, thelucybloom.com, or pick up her latest book, Get the Girls Out, from all good bookstockists.
And you can hear more of our full-length interviews by becoming a Reframe of Mind patron at patreon.com/reframeofmind.
Next time on Reframe of Mind, we continue the theme of best case scenarios, looking at how adaptive our brains truly are.
You can teach an old dog new tricks. I mean, the saying's not right. You can teach an old dog new tricks. But even better than teaching the old dog new tricks is to teach the dog how to discover new ways of doing things.
You've been hearing our story, and now we really want to hear yours.
Connect with @ReframeOfMind on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok and Twitter.
Or connect with @WelcomeChangeMedia on LinkedIn.
You can also contact us via reframeofmind.com.au with your stories or suggestions for future topics.
We'd like to thank today's guests for sharing their personal stories and insights. For more information on any of the subjects, guests or references used in this episode, please see our show notes or reframeofmind.com.au.
Reframe of Mind is a Welcome Change Media production.
Tired of ads crashing your comedy podcast party? Good news. Ad-free listening on Amazon Music is included with your Prime membership. Just head to amazon.com/adfreecomedy to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Enjoy thousands of Acast shows ad-free for Prime subscribers. Some shows may have ads.